We are in officially the deepest, longest recession for 100 years. This is a deeper recession than the 1929-1933 one, and by this time, that is 4 years after the 1929 recession, we were coming out and up and we're back to the point we were in 1929. We're nowhere there at the moment. For those of you who were in sessions earlier in the conference, you'll have heard that the cuts have only just begun. It's just the first part of the cuts that have gone through. Things are going to get worse, and they already are very bad. We've had an absolute drop in living standards of the worst recorded for about 100 years. You can find worse ones in the 1880s, and you might begin to say these things are not comparable. I'm not going to go through the causes of the crisis and so on, because I think you're generally aware of what happened. Safe to say it wasn't an overspending government, it was to do with the banks, but I'm just assuming most people know that. What you may not know is what's been happening more recently, which when you look at income figures released by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, is beginning to show that 99% of people are beginning to come together in Britain. That the income distribution amongst 99% of the population is narrowing, has actually got back to where it was around about 1990, when John Major was in power, so that the cuts at the bottom are equivalent on a percentage scale to the drops in income of people at the top, apart from the top 1%. And the top 1% have carried on moving away. They are the people who a large number live here. This map was produced over 5 years ago, and at the time it was funny. And now it's not so funny. So who do you trust in what's going on? And is there scope to use people's lack of trust? And I'm particularly talking about people in the top 10% in the next 25 minutes or so. There are all kinds of things going on which are very odd or very strange. The next part of the talk comes from a paper I did for the New Statesman magazine, which was about between 20 and 40,000 more elderly people have died in 2012 and 2013 than were expected to die. And I don't think this is unrelated to austerity or what happened after the crash. The reason for the picture of that couple with face masks on is that the deaths that have happened recently in 2012 and 2013 have officially been blamed on the flu, on influenza. But we knew by the end of summer 2013, as we began to get the death certificates for elderly people, that only around about 5% had actually died from the flu. So 95% of these increased deaths were not due to the flu. In fact, we had remarkably low rates of flu in 2012-2013 in comparison to the rest of Europe. Again, why am I showing you a picture of two people wearing masks in the smog? When the smog hit London in the 1950s, the government minister who was in charge was a man called Harold Macmillan, and he announced that these people dying were dying because of the flu. We shouldn't worry, it was a temporary thing, it was an influenza epidemic. It wasn't an influenza epidemic, it was actually the smog, it was air pollution that resulted in that case in 12,000 people dying who need not have died, and certainly didn't die in future when we cleared up the air. So what could it be if it's not the flu? And this is where it becomes tricky to try to guess what it is. There are many things. I mean, the latest one I heard was it's women starting smoking 30 years ago. But it's a very abrupt increase in deaths. It's hard to think that an abrupt increase in deaths could be due to that. You'd expect a smoother increase. What we do know is that this rise in deaths has been amongst elderly people, and predominantly amongst women, far more than even the fact that there are more elderly people who are women. So couples have been more resistant. It's been people who have been on their own. One big possibility, I have 10 possibilities and I won't go through them all with you, but one big possibility is that we've had this huge cut in people, elderly people, getting visits from social services in recent years. I'll show you the reduction. Now there's been quite a lot of evaluations of these visits, and they've said that these visits are pretty useless. These are where somebody turns up, takes off their coat, put the kettle on, make a cup of tea, and 15 minutes later they've got to be out of the house. But the one thing that visiting elderly people should be good for is spotting if there's something very, very badly wrong with the elderly person. At the extreme, you find them falling down the bottom of the stairs. Here's the cuts. They began under Labour. They accelerated when the coalition government came in. They're continuing. And I heard one of the cabinet members for Walford Forest today saying that they've only done a third of their cuts and they've got another third to go. And that all that will be left, I think he was exaggerating somewhat, in 5 years' time, will be care for the elderly. There isn't a budget for collecting the rubbish in the bins. But already you can see the reduction that's occurring. And I'll do the thing you're not supposed to do as a social scientist, but I'll put up the opposite graph. This is the life expectancy of women in the whole of the UK from the age of 65 onwards. This is based on actual deaths that have occurred, and you'll see that it's actually gone down in the most recent period. Those deaths are concentrated in the poorest areas of the country, but have an effect of bringing the overall average down. The other kind of things that might be having an effect, and there's lots of them, and it does relate to housing, is do you remember when those care homes went bust in 2011, 700 of them? Because the hedge fund had bought the care homes and sold off the actual property to landlords, and the landlords wanted to increase the rents. Now, at the end of the day, the care homes didn't actually evict the thousands and thousands of elderly people they were supposed to be caring for. But those elderly people were living for several years in a state of precarity, in not knowing what was going to happen to them. And being precarious, living in a state of precarity, is not good for your health. We have lots of studies of how being poorly housed and worrying about your housing hurts your health. Well, that's just one thing, and those are 700 care homes. The other kind of things that have happened over the last few years, you've had an entire reorganisation of the NHS, the Health and Social Care Act, has gone through. That's diverted attention from public health and other things that would have happened if we hadn't been transforming the NHS at the time. So which group in society is going to be missed out most by the things that didn't happen because of the effort that was going into that? And I'd suggest it probably would be elderly women. Pensioners abroad. You might remember cutting the winter fuel allowances for people living in Spain, and it seeming a very sensible thing to do. Why do you need a winter fuel allowance if you live in Spain? Well, one reason you might need a winter fuel allowance if you live in Spain is that you're only just surviving in Spain, because the pound went down by 20% in 2008, 2009. And if they cut the winter fuel allowance, then it means you've got to come back to Britain. And again, we could have elderly and frail people coming back, and that might have been part of the spike. There are lots and lots of things. We don't really know. What I'm saying about trust is I do think government needs to be able to say why this has happened, or at least get Public Health England, which is the body responsible, to work out or to say what its best guess is to why this has happened, when it comes up with something which only explains 5% of the excess deaths rather than the other 95%. It could be things such as people not visiting their elderly relatives. These are women in their 80s living on their own mainly. And we know that the amount of travelling shot down with the crash, the amount of petrol that people bought shot down, so people didn't go and see relatives as much as they had done before. There are lots of things it could have been. This is the official NHS advice over what to do if you can't afford to heat your home. Because, of course, something else which happened over this period is that the cost of fuel went up. And here's a question about can you trust the NHS? The NHS actually subcontracts to a private company that produces advice and put this advice up on the internet so that 85-year-old women can check the web to see how they should heat their home. I don't think it's been evaluated how many 85-year-old women found this advice useful. The kind of thing it doesn't help, doesn't tell you about is, it has advice saying, for instance, it makes sense to have an electric blanket, which it does make sense to have an electric blanket, but if you're incontinent, electric blankets aren't great. If you have to get out of bed several times a night, then actually turning the heating off in your room you're sleeping isn't good, and so on. But you have to ask, why have we got to a state now where people who are very elderly may not be able to heat themselves? It's not the flu. It may not have actually been the cold, even though it's harder to heat homes now than it was before. The winter of 2009-10 was actually colder, but we didn't have a spike in deaths in 2009-10. And my worry is we've had an increase in callousness. Callousness from the state, so the state can cut these things, rather than do other things it could have done. I think it's now got to the point where only 17% of the crisis has been dealt with by increasing taxes, and something like 83% has been dealt with by cuts. When there was a crisis in the early 80s, it was 50-50. But there's also, worryingly, a rising callousness amongst young people. So when Ipsos Mori poll young people, 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, each year, very, very rapidly, they're finding sympathy for other people, including elderly people, particularly including people who are disabled, is dropping away very, very rapidly. We're heading amongst the young to a much more individualistic set of attitudes. The old can remember, you've got to be quite old, but can remember a time before the welfare state and are more supportive of it. I mean, one of the saddest things about this group of 20 to 40,000 people who've died, increasing numbers who've died, is that these were the people who came of age, a bit later for the women than the men, but came of age and were able to vote in 1945 for the government who brought in the NHS. There are other little pieces of evidence that I think should cause you to worry about who you can trust. Infant mortality in the United States is rising. It doesn't rise in any other rich country in the world. Elderly mortality in the United States rose in 2008, similar to it rising last year. Here, 2008 was the last year of the Bush cuts, George Bush's cuts. Until the rise in mortality that we had in the last couple of years, the only increase in death rates we'd had was in Glasgow, but 2009-2010. And I think if you're worrying about the extremes of precariousness, you have to look at that. But let's just take it back now to all of us and to housing and to the problem of being housed. And I think housing's a good way to look at inequality and to look at the crisis, because all of you have to pay rent or have a mortgage, or maybe five people in this room, maybe less, I'm just trying to guess from stereotyping from your age, own their house outright. And it's probably the largest component of your cost of living at the moment. These figures come from the Financial Times. And to me, this is a remarkable change since 2008. Financial Times, publishing the results of really good analysis produced by the estate agent Savills. Savills are the estate agent to the rich in London. And Savills have produced these figures. And they found that since the crash, since 2009, the wealth of a very small group of people, this is landlords, just 2% of the population are landlords, the wealth of landlords, the net wealth, has increased by 245 billion. The wealth of average mortgage holders, or all mortgage holders put together, has reduced by 169 billion because elderly ones have left the system and the ones coming in have had to borrow a lot. You'll see their figures show you an even increase, a higher increase over 10 years, the wealth of landlords. What happened when the crisis hit the population in general in 2008, 9 and 10 in this country is that the number of transactions on the open market halved. It's people buying houses. It halved in 2008 compared to 2006, 2007. It stayed at a level for 2009, 10, 11. It's just started creeping up in 2012 and then rose a bit higher in 2013. But when the number of transactions halves, people still have to move. And so those who sell end up renting. And landlords end up buying their houses when they sell them at prices that have reduced and can charge higher rents because the demand for rented property increases. That's why rents have been going up by 10% a year in London. If you can charge higher rents, you suddenly end up with a very large amount of cash in your pocket. And what do you do with that cash? You buy another house. You buy another house, particularly in the southeast of England and London. That's how landlords have ended up having such a big increase in their wealth. A lot of it is the actual rent being paid because landlords tend not to be that enthusiastic about spending money doing up the property if they can get people in because people are desperate for somewhere to rent. And they've been buying up property in just that part of the country where the property prices have been rising. This figure is the proportion of households with children in England who are now private renting. And it ends in 2012, so I'm almost certain it's over a quarter. So one in four households with kids now private renting. And you'll see just how fast it is. Now, to me, and this is why I'm interested in you asking me questions, to me, this is cock-up. I honestly don't believe a group of people met on a yacht in 2008 and said, now's our chance, we'll take Britain back to the Victorian era. We'll get it back to a mass renting culture for families with children. Over who you can trust, this is actually the Social Mobility and Child Poverty Commission, who I don't agree with many of the things they do, but I think it's lovely they've released things like this, and show us that something quite dramatic really is happening. We had a small private rented sector. We needed a bigger private rented sector. Lots of people need to rent privately, but of all the people who need to rent, the group who have the least need to rent are families with children, because families with children want to try and stay in the same place because kids really don't like moving home. They have an aversion to changing school and they're slightly upset by having to lose all their friends and make new friends and lose all their friends again and make new friends. The average tenancy in London is lasting a year, and the people who find it hardest to rent privately in London, remember this is nationally, this is England, one in four, so in London it's much, much higher. The people who find the rent hardest to pay are families with children, because they've got less disposable income, because they're paying for the clothes and foods for the kids, so they can be outbid by a couple without any kids, which is why they're having to move. This little graph here is just showing you how much the 1% take as a proportion of income all the way from 1920 to around about 2000, 2005, in the socialist utopia of Switzerland and the Netherlands. Just because when people tell you it's inevitable, it's a global race, the rich getting richer benefits us all, I'm interested in why they don't tell you that doesn't happen in the Netherlands and in Switzerland. Swiss bankers are paid half as much as our bankers are paid. And I think these things are connected. If you remember, I told you landlords are just 2% of the population. Not all landlords are nasty. Not all of them are getting very rich. I reckon about half. That's about 1% of the population. But they're not all in the 1%. They're not actually all rich enough to get in the 1%. If any of you are worrying what the 1% is, if you want to know whether you're in this group, if you're taking home with your partner, if you've got a partner, about £160,000 a year, and you haven't got any kids, you're in the 1%. If you've got kids, you need about 200,000. If you're on your own, maybe 140,000 gets you in to the 1%. And that's the kind of era we're in, where we have that group who's actually seeing their income rising at the moment. I say group, there's more inequality within the 1% than there is in the other 99%. And although the 1% are getting richer, they're actually stretching out at an incredible rate. So if you're at the bottom of the 1%, it's very easy to feel hard done by. I'll give you an example globally. Do you remember the Oxfam? Was it about four weeks ago produced a stat saying 85 people have the same as the poorest, was it, billion in the world? Yeah. 2 days ago, Forbes magazine released a new stat showing it was 67 people. And yesterday, Forbes magazine corrected it to say it's now 66 people. That's the increase in wealth at the very, very top. And that's within Britain, we see the same for the 0.001% are doing much better than the 0.01% who are doing better than the 0.01% who are doing better than the other 90% of the 1%. So you're getting this group who are pulling apart. And at the same time, when we stop worrying about the 1%, you've got the Children's Commissioner trying to explain who's most affected by the cuts. Thomas Piketty's got a book that was published by Penguin about 2 weeks ago. And the most important graph in his book is this book, this graph, I think. Because this is sort of showing what you can do about it, or trying to explain how does Switzerland and the Netherlands manage not to have its 1% going out of control, and how do countries like the US and the UK fail. This is the change in the top tax rate since 1960. Switzerland has managed to keep the same top tax rate since 1960, fairly high top tax rate. Netherlands has a 20% reduction, not doing quite as well, but we've had a massive almost 50% reduction, similar to the US. On this scale is how much extra the 1% have taken as a proportion of all income. Our 1% have taken about 15% of all income, 6% more than they used to take. In the US it's almost doubled, they're taking a fifth of all income, leaving 80% for the other 99%. What high top tax rates do isn't raise much money. What having a 70 or 80% tax rate, say over £500,000 income, does is help explain to a youngish man, probably younger than me, I'm thinking of the banker who the head of RBS complained about at Christmas, young man getting £4 million a year, who's very upset because he heard his friend's getting £6 million a year, and he wants to get £6 million a year, and he's going to leave RBS unless RBS increases his income to £6 million a year. Now, a high top tax rate helps you not want to have that pay increase as much, because you're not going to get the money. It's going to go in tax. And it's a deterrent for people at the top to be too greedy. People often complain that high tax rates will stop you being creative or something. My favourite complaint is the Beatles, who actually produced a song about the taxman, because they were so upset that they were paying tax at well over 90% on their earnings. But it didn't stop the Beatles being successful. I'm going to begin to wrap up now, because it is Friday afternoon. But do think of questions, particularly if you're thinking, what planet is he on? How can he sort of say things are as simple as this? Fern actually gave me this idea, which is looking at precarity in terms of housing. You know, we have a big living wage campaign in London and in Oxford, trying to get people on £8 odd an hour rather than, if you're young, £6 odd an hour.
And Birmingham.
And Birmingham, okay. But what's the point of it if you don't pay a living rent? You know, if rents are increasing at 10% a year, what do you actually secure by the time you've got your £8 something? There are lots and lots of things I think need to happen to do with housing. I don't think you need to do all of them at once. But what worries me at the moment is I think government policy is to try to maximise house prices for election day, because it's the surest way of the current Conservatives getting an overall majority. I'll put it as simple. That's honestly what I think. And I would love to hear a reason why I shouldn't be as cynical. The Help to Buy scheme, if you may know about it, it's all about getting banks to lend to people that the banks don't think they should lend to. It's underwritten by us. If you've got a 5% deposit, so if you manage to save or get from your parents 5%, you can buy a house now, buy it quickly. The taxpayer will guarantee the next 20%. So if house prices fall by 25%, you'll lose your 5%. We'll lose 20% on your behalf. We're planning to guarantee 130 billion and the Help to Buy. And only if they fall by more than 25% will the bank lose anything. Danny Blanchflower, former member of the government, the Monetary Policy Committee, has predicted a 25% fall in house prices. I don't necessarily think house prices are going to fall. I just don't think it's great to try to get them to rise. We have about 40 million rooms that are bedrooms or could be bedrooms that are empty on any one night. We're not using our housing stock well. The only part of the housing stock we use well is social housing, and the only bit where we're actually having a go at empty bedrooms is in social housing, where there are hardly any empty bedrooms and hardly anywhere to go if you are kicked out of your room. We could bring in 5-year tenancy agreements. This is what Shelter suggests, and this would help calm landlords down to stop them buying up every last house. I don't think we should have tax relief, which we do have for landlords but not for other people, and you can see I've got a thing against landlords at the moment. We don't enforce the criminal law on landlords, so that when they put a family in the bedroom, we don't put the landlord in jail for having done that, and I think that might help as well. This is a picture of a homeless girl in Sheffield phoning her key worker to try to get to bed for a night. And I'm just going to leave you with this text to read of how I try... I've made Ludi squint at the front now. How I think all these things are connected. I don't think you can make a mint as a banker fixing the LIBOR rate or the Forex rate, which is the latest scandal, and the money you make come out of nowhere. Somebody's losing out, somebody's winning. When people buy homes, as we were told earlier by a man who's gone back up to Lancaster, but a friend who's just bought a house in Waltham Forest and hopes to double their money in the next 5 years, that money, if they make it, has to come... It won't double in the next 5 years. That money has to come from somebody. Housing isn't a magic money-making machine. It can't just be used to make some people rich and not harm other people. So who don't we trust or why should we worry? This is my last slide, so please do think of a question. This is what London looks like if you draw each borough of London the size of the actual value of the property that's in there. And this is all owned by somebody. We're currently producing the map where we wrap the rest of the country around London. But you may not be surprised to find that, in fact, London is a very large proportion of the wealth of the entire country. And in a sense, that is your vested interest. That is one set of people who actually happen to own that property and think they have this much money, who really don't want things changing that much in favour of everybody else. And they may not even think about it consciously like that. But that is where the bulk of the wealth of the country actually is. It's bricks and mortar, and it's largely in London, and an enormous amount of it's in the middle of London. So you can take three entire regions of the north of England and add them on top of this, and they're smaller than London. And this distorts and changes our thinking. And I'll just give you one last fact to get you thinking about this. I think we should pay MPs more. And the reason I think we should pay MPs a little bit more is that because we don't pay them more, we did something else instead. Now, it wasn't the expenses scheme, although that was bad. But, you know, Maggie said you can have these generous expenses, but we won't put your pay up. What we did for MPs is we helped them get houses in London. And some of them have got a lot of houses in London. Michael Meachers, who's a Labour MP, has got 11, at least, flats. 25% of members of Parliament are currently landlords. I can understand how hard it must be for members of Parliament to appreciate the problems of housing in London when they are personally so well housed in London. And if you're trying to understand why did they just say build more houses, it'll all be okay, rather than worrying about the sharing out, it's partly because we've paid them in housing, principally in houses in London, instead of paying them in a salary. And that, I think, must have an effect on their thinking. Thank you very much on a Friday evening for listening to me. Thank you.